This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Eleanor, what I want to do is talk about welfare and all our plans to overhaul it. And some of you will have seen that we're getting ourselves in gear and today, and I suspect there'll be a bit of a few questions around it, which I shall enjoy answering.
Well, just for those of us who have been locked in here all day, the statement this morning...
I'll come to it. I'll put it in a context. And I should point out, when Eleanor bullies me like this, that Eleanor took me on my first ever game of tennis.
God, I've forgotten that.
And she was... She spent most of the time explaining to me why I could not possibly play like Ilina Stasi on my very first outing. So, as you can tell, we go back a long way. So, there's two things, at least, that need to happen to transform welfare. And the first is the whole welfare to work agenda, and I'll come on to that, obviously, and with what we've been doing today. But the second bit of the agenda, which we're beginning to raise our skirts just ever so gently about, is benefits reform and the structure of the benefits system. And reforming both of those, among other things, is a major priority for the coalition government. In fact, it was at the very top of the Queen's speech. You could call it almost the number one priority, or number after, anyway, getting the fiscal deficit down. So I want to talk about both those areas today and try and give you a feeling of where we're coming from. Why reform? The first area is the welfare to work area, is simply, as it stands, not doing what we need it to do. And what we need it to do is to take all the people who've been marginalised in society and get them back into the workforce. I mean, many of you in the audience will know me, and the thing that has transformed attitude in this area is the fact that the new consensus following the Waddle and Burton report is that work is good for people with problems. It is not, you don't try and defend them from work, you actually try and help them into work. And that's got to be a priority. And we simply have not been doing that on the scale, intensity, and single-minded focus that it's needed. And today, just to respond to Eleanor's urgent request, we announced the next stage today in a ministerial statement saying we are going to launch the work programme. We are therefore giving notice that all these other programmes will be folded into it. And there's a process, a series of letters have gone out to providers to discuss how that we may most elegantly ensure that we fold over people's activities into the new regime. And clearly that is going to be something that we'll be extraordinarily anxious to make sure that all the good performers, all the people who are committed and doing well are able to take their full place and perform in a very much bigger programme, which gives them much more freedom. The core of our transformation really is we want to move away from inputs and into procedures and things you've got to do into outcomes. What we want is to get people into the world of work in a sustained basis. We don't want anything else. That's what we want. That's what we want to pay for. And clearly in the system we need to protect people who cannot work, support them, and make sure that we consolidate support for the vulnerable. And you'll all be aware that Ian Duncan Smith, my new boss, how much this part of the agenda is at the heart of what he's worrying about, social justice. He is running a cabinet committee of social justice now to make sure that works. We've got Frank Field looking at the poverty issues. So this, the support for the people who cannot help themselves, is right at the heart of what we want to try and make sure as we try and help people in the workplace. The third thing, as I said, is making sure that work actually pays for those who can. And those of you who have any nodding familiarity with the benefits of system will know that this is a nightmare from hell, and it has got to be changed. That is because the people who are being failed by the present system are the most disadvantaged. And over the last 10 years, we have seen welfare dependency growing really substantially. We've now got 4.9 million, nearly 5 million people claiming out-of-work benefits, which is the highest figure since, this millennium. The last time it was as high as this was in 1998-99. There are 4.8 million working-age adults living in households where no one at all works. And there's an incredible number of 1.4 million people receiving out-of-work benefits and have been for the last 9 out of the 10 years. In-work dependency has actually increased very substantially over the past 10 years when you look at the effect of the tax credit system. And tax credits now can be relied upon or taken by people way up the earnings cycle. We've got child tax credit, which can be taken by parents who together are living in households earning more than £50,000, and which means that two-parent families can be taking, you know, dependency payments, tax credits, out of the state when they're earning more than the national average. So here we are. We've got a system topping up earnings well into the comfort zone, and we don't put our money where it counts to address the root causes of poverty. I must give credit where it is due, however. The previous administration has begun to move in the right direction. The policies on welfare to work are beginning to generate the kind of focus and industry that we need to address the problem. And that's one of the reasons that we can step on the accelerator as we have today. The work programme does represent a clean break. It's a simple system. It's going to be coherent, transparent. It'll remove barriers. Essentially, it's going to allow providers to determine their own strategies and use their own methods to get people back into work. And that's going to be done by the outcome-based financing that I described. What we're going to do is make sure that the hardest to help are put into the specialist programme, this single specialist programme, right from the start of the claim, rather than prolong their dependency with the more limited support that the job centres provide. The way that's going to happen, what you happen with an outcome-based system with a pricing rate card, i.e. the ones who are the hardest to help, we will pay up more for. That will inevitably produce a far more individualised response and a far more individualised, far more tailored to individual need. And you then create a system where providers will start to segment the kind of provision that they will offer, the specialisations they'll do. There'll be incentives, or the system will incentivise the creation of consortia with all kinds of specialisms within it, and we will encourage that kind of what we're calling rich consortia. We just won't meddle. I'm determined that in this system, we will let business go, and we will not meddle. When I say business, I mean private and voluntary companies. Now, let's go on to the benefits. Work simply does not pay for many on the lowest incomes. And it is often more rational for people to stay on benefits than go into work. And frankly, I don't blame those people. I think I've actually been quoted as if I've been blaming people. I blame the system. I blame a system that doesn't encourage people back into the workplace. And when you count the extra things about going back in, the travel to work, the lunch, the passported benefits you risk, there's a huge problem of getting back to work. And that's just when you look at it on a spreadsheet. People in this area do not have spreadsheets. But they understand risk. They understand risk. They understand if you get out of a situation you've painfully constructed around yourself to protect your standard of living and yourself, not at a very high level, but it's been hard to get there, hard to get those benefits. The risks you undertake to try and change the situation are overwhelming. And, you know, people understand risk and reward. And given that just on the spreadsheet, it often isn't worth it, when you take the risk factor in, it really isn't worth it. So we need to re-incentivize work as a real limited risk or no risk option. And the work done by Ian Duncan Smith has, in the Centre for Social Justice, really has been eye-opening. There was one particular piece of work called Dynamic Benefits, which I think is about 400 pages. I read that cover to cover twice because it is riveting stuff. I commend it to all of you who like that kind of thing. And two of you. And what we're trying to do now is implement many of the ideas in there. And the ideas are pretty sophisticated. It's not about lowering payments to encourage people off benefit. It is about breaking the barrier between in-work support and out-of-work support so that the transition is smooth. Getting rid of those rate of withdrawal of benefit, which can be up in the 90%, or even worse, it might not be at the 90%, but you don't know. So watch this space on that, I think, is my...
How long have we got to watch it for?
I think we're talking weeks, not months. Let's put it like this. I hope we are talking weeks. We're doing a lot of work on it, and I hope we're talking weeks and not months. Certainly for the skirt to get up around the calf. Or the trouser. Anyway, the next thing is incapacity. This is a trap. There's a story, and I can't remember the exact figures. Merthyr Tydfil, when it had its steelworks, had 4,000 able-bodied people working in it. When it was closed, 2 years later, there were 3,500 people on IB, because that was the best benefit. And what does that do if you trap people in an inactive benefit? What it does, it means that no employer, you haven't got a pool of labour that an employer can use. You've locked it away. So we need to unlock the labour, and that is what this idea of moving everyone off incapacity benefit into employment and support allowance is designed to do, or actually many of them will move straight into JSA. There are 2.6 million people claiming IB, which costs us, the taxpayer, $13.5 billion in direct payments. And that leads to the next point, the sheer cost of the system. The forecast is that there's going to be $51 billion pounds spent on working age benefits in 2010-11. That's 3.5% of GDP, that's 7% of all government spending. In total, DWP spends $150 billion on all benefits and pensions, and that doesn't even include tax credits and child benefit, which you can add another $40 billion on. That is 50% more than the NHS spend, three times the spend on schools and defence individually. So I think I'm the biggest spender in the country. So we do need to reform the system to cut the costs. Partly we'll do that by increasing conditionality. But in the end, in the system that we're going to go to, the work programme, we're looking for the provider community to invest up front, invest early to get people back out, and then we can reward them with the money that we're saving. We hope with the work programme we're going to see the best of both worlds. More people entering the world of work, more people entering mainstream society, less money from the taxpayer. I won't say this is going to be easy. This is not going to be easy. And I'm not going to say it's not going to be contentious. I mean, there is a large measure of support for these moves from people that you wouldn't necessarily think would be supporters, from anti-poverty charities, disability groups. They can see what we're trying to do here. We try to take lessons from the countries that are ahead in this, the Australians, the Dutch, the Netherlands, New York, and we're getting these plans championed across the political spectrum. I talked about Frank Field leading this review on poverty. It's a key task, the key task, as I said, and if we can do it, the prize is very great. So I now look forward to being grilled by the experts on the platform with me. Should I sit? Come and sit.
I'm not an expert, but I thought you were using...
Experts in grilling, Eleanor.
Oh, expert in grilling. I just thought you were using slightly weasel words when you talked about increasing conditionality. What did you mean that? Does that mean tougher penalties if you don't work? And what kind of things are we talking about? I mean, you can't, as we know, use the financial penalty always because of driving parents into poverty, which their children suffer.
Well, at one level, we're saying that the people on IB, where there is no conditionality, are now going to go into regimes where they are expected to do things. So at one level, it's very simple. You're actually taking a huge number of people and actually effectively asking a large number of them, they'll be expected to do things. You've touched on a point about sanctioning. Sanctioning is a very interesting concept in this area. I think in the end, you need to tell people, unless you do certain things, you're not in this benefit. That's the conditions of it. But I do think that we need to look very hard at non-financial sanctions as well, because what happens a lot with financial sanctions, when people are not particularly well off, they go to the social fund, they get the money back as a loan. So you don't effectively do the sanctioning. And exploring non-financial sanctions is something.
What kind of things could they be?
Well, I think making life more inconvenient. If you can't fine people with money, you can fine people with their time and convenience. So that's one area that I think we should explore more actively than we have.